Hey everybody, this is Alex Merced, and welcome to another episode of My Tech Podcast, where I just talk about technical things that are on my mind. And one of the top of mind things are usually, again, have been AI. So I talk a lot about a lot of the new models that are coming out. I've been working on building two different harnesses. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a little bit. But essentially, what's been interesting is seeing just sort of all the different ways that a model can be good. Because everyone just kind of looks at the same benchmarks and says, oh, look, this one has beat this one in the benchmark. And most of that focuses on intelligence. But then there's also the factor of token efficiency. So a lot of these models that maybe perform really well with numbers and even sometimes look cheaper because they're not token efficient, they end up using more tokens because they do more reasoning. They do much more verbose reasoning to get to your final answer. They end up being more expensive, even if they have a cheaper per token price. Then there's also the per token pricing. So you take a look at a model like DeepSeek V4, the new one, like basically they did a re-release of V4 as the production version of V4 Flash. It's actually really good at a really good price. Again, oftentimes ends up balancing out. Oftentimes, again, those cheaper models, they just are less token efficient. So you spend more, or you spend more than you think you're going to spend on long running tasks. But again, these are also things that can be, that's just on the benchmarks. What I think a lot of people forget is that we've been optimizing with less intelligent models for a long time. So we know how to compensate for that, whether it's by using skills, through context engineering, prompt engineering, nowadays through things like loop and graph engineering. There are a lot of ways to take a model that isn't the cutting edge model and actually make it work really, really well for you. I think oftentimes we forget about all the things that we've learned along the way. So you can take those much cheaper models like a DeepSeek V4 and probably get it to be just as efficient to save even more money than you see just on the basic sticker price. But this is also performance. Again, I think a thing that hasn't been focused on as much, but now that Google has come out with 3.7 Flash, which is really fast. I mean, I've been playing with it and it just like finishes things. Like sometimes I have to like double ask it, like, did you do it right? A few times, because I'm just like, it gets done so fast that I just didn't even realize it did the thing. And then I go back and like, hey, yeah, it did the thing I asked it to do. So again, may not necessarily be the raw model itself may not be the most intelligent model, but within the right harness, with the right prompts, with the right context engineering, with the right skills, it's pretty powerful and also super fast. Like I'm just seeing it just finish things like right away, quicker than I would have ever sort of dreamed an AI model to be able to complete things. And it's still a pretty cheap model, not the cheapest, but for how fast it gets things done, it's pretty nice. I can get a lot of things done much faster. And that's another thing about Google specifically. I think a lot of people are like been really bagging on Google because it hasn't come out with 3.5 Pro yet. Does anyone even still want 3.5 Pro at this point? Wouldn't I prefer to have a 3.7 Pro? Or even just have them skip to Gemini 4 Pro at this point? But again, what matters for Google is, because at the end of the day, the Gemini models are mainly for the integrations they have within the Google ecosystem. It's not mainly for people to be plugging into external harnesses. You can. Okay, I've used Gemini models in external harnesses. But at the end of the day, like where Gemini really shines is because of the robust ways that it's integrated into the Google tooling. And when I'm using like Google Docs or Gemini Notebook or any of these kinds of tools, it's a really good experience. And I enjoy using those tools. And I end up using Gemini a lot through my use of the grander Google platform. And in that regard, like focusing on creating fast, cheap models, because you're trying to make sure that the experience that people are using your overall platform is crisp, I think they're focusing on what they need for the customers they're targeting. Not necessarily like long-running coding. Like, yes, they can make money on API pricing for long-running coding, but at the end of the day, Google makes money on enterprises by one of the ways that Google makes money is enterprises paying for like the Google suite of tools. And oftentimes they're not going to necessarily pay for an additional high-end AI subscription. But if the level of AI that you get with that tooling is really good, that just makes the Google Workspace stuff stickier, and maybe they pay for the AI upgrades for some users or whatever they decide to do. But it makes it where, hey, you don't need to go buy a Claude Enterprise account. You can just use your Google account, and it can do a lot of those things for you. I enjoy using anti-gravity a bit. I mean, I just like VS Code, and I like the way the anti-gravity IDE works. I haven't really worked as much with the CLI. A little bit with the desktop software, like the codecs. Like the one big complaint I have there is that they haven't added a feature that is like Claude Dispatch or the remote feature on codecs, where I can just leave codecs and Claude desktop on my laptop, and then I can then send commands to the agent to go do stuff on my laptop from a distance, which has been fantastically useful for doing things while I'm abroad, since I've been traveling a lot. And I have a lot of things that are just particularly on my home laptop, just because of the particular setup I have here, the particular software and hardware that I have here at home that isn't necessarily portable, nor do I necessarily want to co-locate on my work travel laptop. So that's been fantastic to be able to kind of work a lot on my work and personal projects remotely using the full power of my home work system wherever I'm at. There's that. And then, of course, I've been playing with Hermes. You've mentioned that I've been playing with Hermes a lot, and it just gets better and better. Like, what I did, actually, I spent the day and had Hermes. I just asked Hermes, like, hey, you know what I've been using you for. Are there tools, like CLI tools and skills, that you can create that'll specifically help you with those things? And it created all sorts of different CLI tools that now cuts the time it takes to do a lot of these tasks in half, or even more so, because basically a lot of the more deterministic parts of it are now encoded in these custom CLI tools that it created for itself, which saves me a lot of time. And again, those CLI tools are housed on my home laptop, but I can use them abroad because I can communicate to Hermes via Slack. And again, you can set that up with Telegram, whatever chat app you prefer. But to me, that's like really useful. And then like the quality of like the new versions of DeepSeek V4 Flash and V4 Pro makes it where it's really cheap to use Hermes pretty aggressively to do all sorts of things like updating software on my computer and, again, creating its own CLI tools, things like that. Claude, I'm actually starting to like appreciate the way Claude Dispatch work, or Claude Cowork in general, or Claude Code works within the Claude desktop a bit more. Before, because I mainly use it through Dispatch, it just seemed like it was just one ongoing prompt. I didn't realize that if I'm using it at home, sitting at home, because I would usually default to anti-gravity at home, that it does feel a little bit different. And I'm really preferring it because I can give it like usually with like anti-gravity, I'll open things up and create projects out of very specific project folders. So that way, you know, Gemini and Opus 4.6, they're only touching a very specific workspace. But with like Opus 5, I can open it up to my broader like development folder, which is where I kind of house everything. And it generally hasn't had any issues with just being able to operate between my different projects and make sure that it understands which is what project and what repos what, and then how to, when I ask it to create new things, where to put them. It's been pretty good about that. And I've been able to kind of like pull back. And then I found that I'm not even like really scratching the surface of my Claude and OpenAI Max subscriptions. So I kind of downgraded them all to like the $100 level for a lot of my AI subscriptions that were originally at the Max. And I was just spending way too much money a month. I was getting near to like $1,000 a month just in AI subscriptions. That was not sustainable. But now I have a better idea sort of like, hey, which subscriptions I use, how much I use them. So I was able to adjust all these different memberships to whatnot. And for some of like the cheaper ones that I have, that I have not really maximized my use of, like OpenCode Go, I've canceled. I do have like reoccurring top ups. So like I do put in like maybe $10 a month into providers like OpenGo. OpenCode but that's for OpenCode Zen, OpenRouter, Noose Portal. I'll put in like $10 a month, and then that's enough. I won't end up actually using it, and then I have the credits remaining, so there's no need for me to do the subscription with the because just kind of the top off each month is working well, because I'm mainly using DeepSeek V4, with these particular, with these other external routers that I use to plug into harnesses like OpenCode or Pi. I just downloaded Prime Agent, the custom agents that I created, Loro and Mag Agent, which I'll talk about more in a moment. So that's been good. So like basically I've been just kind of assessing sort of like how I use. But going back to Hermes for a second, another thing I did is I actually had to train or create skills around the other agent tools that I have. So like Grok Build, the Cursor CLI, Prime Agent, all these other different CLI tools. So that way, even though those don't necessarily have a gateway type thing, like in a sense where I can talk to it through Slack, I can give directions to Hermes to then leverage my other AI tools remotely, and it has a pretty good understanding of doing them. So this has allowed me to kind of get more leverage out of my subscriptions when I travel, because I travel a lot. I'm constantly traveling around the world, speaking at different events. So that's been actually really, really cool. Now, the next part is I have been delving a lot into sort of like the edge of sort of how do you engineer AI systems. So in this case, like the big thing now is like graph engineering, and graph engineering is really just an extension. Essentially, if you were a software engineer or a data engineer, these are not new concepts. Okay, so if you were like a data engineer, you probably use something called DBT. DBT is essentially a graph, and you were engineering a specifically something called a DAG, a directed acyclical graph, because you wouldn't repeat anything. But the idea is you would basically breaking up a bunch of steps in processing data in a deterministic way that can be repeatable. And so essentially creating this like chart of, hey, these are the steps. Here's the order that you run them. This step depends on this step, these kinds of things. What are the success criteria, whatnot? And then same thing with, you know, you also software developers may use tools like Airflow. Data engineers, well, anyone could possibly use Airflow. It's just an orchestrator saying, hey, there's a bunch of things I want to do in a particular order. Let me create a DAG that automates those tasks in that particular order. So if you've done software engineering, data engineering, you're probably familiar with like Airflow, DBT, in doing those things specifically. So graph engineering is just that applied to AI. Okay, so essentially an individual task is a loop, basically saying, this is the thing I want you to do. It is not complete till you meet this benchmark or this success criteria. So that's a loop. It'll just repeat itself until the success criteria is achieved. Problem is that trying to use a loop for a long-running task is that there's a lot of steps in between that you're not defining success of. So what you're doing, so with graph engineering, you're just taking what people were doing with like loop engineering and saying, hey, build me a video game that does this. You're breaking down to a much more specific granular task into a bunch of mini loops, and then creating essentially a graph, basically defining the relationship between these individual loops. Now the question is, how do you do that mechanically? Like, you could just do that with harnesses as they are. I could sit there and say, okay, well, first let's define my tasks, create a document that has all your different tasks, basically define all your loop prompts, do the first loop prompt, open up a session, run it, open up another session. If there's anything that can run in parallel, run that, and then have those different loops run in parallel. But again, that would require you to sort of be there kicking off all these different sessions and kicking off all these loops. So the idea with a graph is you would have a system sort of designed to automate that. So that's what I've been working on. I created a open specification for how to define a graph as like JSON or YAML. I'll be putting out some blogs on this. So if you don't follow me on LinkedIn, follow me on LinkedIn. And then building that into the two harnesses that I'm building. Mag Agent, which is a harness that I was building based on having sort of also using graphs, but using graphs for memory. Okay, so there's a lot of uses for graphs. So the idea is that it actually has a memory graph that it kind of manages under the hood. And now you'd be able to define this sort of execution graph that provides it detailed instructions for how to execute things. And then there's a whole concept of a knowledge graph. I'm not going to get into that right now. But that's the idea is to kind of create like this more sort of self-evolving agent. But unlike a Pi, which is sort of like rewriting like system prompts and whatnot, it's doing it by just sort of enhancing this graph that it has access to. Then there's Loro. Okay, if you notice, I like birds. So basically, Mag Agent was short for magpie. Magpies and parrots, they are birds that use tools, are very intelligent, thus kind of makes sense with AI. So Mag Agent is short for like magpie agent. And that's what that is. And then loro is Spanish for parrot. And that one is takes from a different approach. The idea there is to build sort of an enterprise AI CLI harness. The idea being that I could install this as like a employee at an enterprise and then connect it to the larger knowledge base, the larger knowledge graph of the enterprise via something like a Postgres, like a shared Postgres, a shared lakehouse via something like an Apache Polaris, and then be able to connect to that to have access to all that knowledge of the using governed credentials so that way he has access to whatever sort of I should have access to do tasks, and then also kind of leverage it as memory so that we have a shared memory, our shared enterprise memory. So that was sort of what I'm working on there. But what I've done is I took this graph spec and then implemented it in both. And now I'm creating another public spec for how do you define agents. So like, you know, one of the cool things that came out this week was a Grokbot where you can create these sort of defined agents. So this is like my travel agent. This is my food planning agent. And it's not just a single chat that you have to go then dig through. It's like an agent that continues living. The only difference is that they're kind of living within this persistent compute. So you're paying, so that's why Grokbot's so expensive. You have to pay for this kind of a running computer that's going to exist to back up your account. And then even then, you'll kind of maximize this usage pretty quick if you start really using it. So it's a really expensive proof of concept. But I think they're kind of on the right idea of being able to kind of define this persistent team. So how do you do that without having to persist compute? Well, how about you persist the identity? So I'm creating like a new spec that's like, how do you persist sort of the profile, the biography of a particular agent as like JSON and YAML. So that way, if you start a new session for that particular agent, you don't have to have one long running session. You can create a new session, but it's with the same personality. So very similar to what you do with, let's say, a custom GBT or a gem, but done as sort of an open spec that can work across multiple harnesses. Okay, I can so that way, if I were to switch from like, let's say, harness X to harness Y, I can still use all my predefined agents. They would know what tools they should have available to them, or what tools they should be thinking about using, and which ones they shouldn't be using, thinking about using. What is their personality? What model should they use? Etc. Assuming that, you know, again, the harness can support these things and multiple providers and all that. So right now I'm in the process of designing that spec and then once again implementing that into Loro and MagAgent. So again, you can follow all this by just following me on LinkedIn and following my blogs and my Substack and all that stuff. So that's my thoughts on like AI this week. Beyond that, other things are kind of interesting. What else? Like phones have been pretty interesting to me lately. Like I'm pretty happy with my iPhone. What's been really interesting to me really is more like high-end Android phones, mainly as an alternative to a Steam Deck. Like I have a Steam Deck and I have plenty of gaming devices, so I'm not lacking in my ability to play games if I wanted to play a high-end game. But I do find what's possible pretty interesting in the sense that like if you really just wanted to play like really decent quality like Steam indie games, you could spend like $200, a little bit more than $200 on a Retroid Pocket 6 and have like a pretty good experience and be able to play quite a few games. I do the same thing with like an Iron Thor. An Iron Thor is about the same power as a Retroid Pocket 6. The only nice thing about the Iron Thor is you get the second screen and it's more like a DS that flips open. And I like having a flippable handheld for when I'm traveling. It's just less headaches as far as trying to like protect the screen and things like that. So it makes like the perfect travel device, and I can play games like Blueprints on it and a lot of my favorite RPGs. So I have all my retro games on there, but then I have plenty of modern indies, which are generally the games I prefer anyways. You know, like basically modern Metroidvanias and roguelikes that are just great to play on a plane. Not super graphically intense. Like I'm not gonna play like Cyberpunk on there. But on a high-end phone, you can do that. Like nowadays, like basically the ability to play PC gaming on an Android device has gotten a lot better. So I've been looking into phones like that are running sort of like the latest Snapdragon chips. So these would be like the new, the newer Samsungs, the newer Oppos, the newer Red Magic phones that really have the highest end chip. I think it's even a better chip than what's inside the Ein Odin 3. that theoretically should give you pretty decent power. I think they have shown that you can play Cyberpunk on like the Red Magic, the newest Red Magic phone. So I've been following that really interesting, just because I've been thinking about maybe like, hey, what if I instead of carrying my phone and a gaming device, what if my phone was my gaming device? Like, you can game on an iPhone, but you can't play like Steam games on an iPhone very well, like, or at all. Like, you can do some streaming here and there, but like, really, you're really limited as far as like your gaming options on an iPhone relative to an Android device. With an Android device, you get pretty much the full gambit of retro gaming. You can play PC games. You can stream to whatever device or from any device to your phone. Like, it's, you got a pretty good gambit of what you want to play. Like, you could theoretically with like an Xbox, I forget what they call it, the Xbox Game Pass, you can pretty much play Xbox games right from your phone using the streaming feature. And it's actually not a bad experience at all. So that's something that's been sort of on my mind lately. I did just play Dispatch, which was a fantastic game. If you haven't played Dispatch yet, please play it. It's a fun story. Again, it's not so much of a game. Like, there is gameplay, and the gameplay is fun, but it's not much. But the story is so good. And the way it's told, and the characters, like, if they don't make a season 2 to the game, I would hope that they just turn it to a full-blown animated TV show, because I could definitely live in that world for several more seasons, even if I don't get to play it, because I know they probably want to go build other games and tell other stories through that kind of that level of gameplay. Because again, it took years, I think it took some 7 years to make Dispatch, because it's not just telling a story, but it's also telling all the permutations from the decisions you make and whatnot, to get that full story. Like, your decisions don't change the overall path too much, but there's enough sort of alternate scenes as you go through that. And there's like two major decisions that do have sort of major ramifications throughout your gameplay aspect of the game, that it takes a while to just kind of record all that voice work. So Play Dispatch is my point. Play Dispatch, it's awesome. I mean, it's already done really well, so I'm sure they'll do more with at least the setting, whether it's a TV show or a follow-up DLC to the game, or second season of the game. But I really, really, really enjoyed my experience. I've been wanting to play Dispatch for a while, finally got around to it, and was not disappointed. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that's been on my mind regarding like tech and things. Aside from that, that's been mainly the thing, just kind of thinking for far as like gaming devices and how far you can push gaming, especially with the increasing cost of gaming hardware. Because you're seeing like now consoles are starting to get to the point where they're $1,000. And with the next round of price increases on a PS5, you know, people thought the Steam machine, the Steam essentially gaming computer, was a little pricey, but it's looking a lot less pricey relative to these consoles as these consoles keep going up in price. I mean, technically, right now, the Switch is probably the best value in gaming next to buying like a Retroid Pocket 6. Retroid Pocket 6 would probably be the best value as far as like the amount of money you spend versus the power that you get and what you can do. But, Switch would sort of be in that same vein, or Switch 2. But they're still pretty pricey because their prices have gone up as well. So, you know, basically computers in general are just getting more expensive. So trying to figure out how do you get more value out of those computing dollars has been something that I've been thinking a lot about. Like, I got computers of pretty decent power that are in great shape. So I don't particularly have that worry, but I always like to know. So that way I know, one, how I can advise others. And also just know in case, you know, what if like a hurricane comes and destroys all my stuff? How do I replenish? How do I rebuild? That kind of thing. So that's been mainly what's on my mind. There's a lot. I know I don't have as much to say about the data space today. I will. I have a lot of really cool stuff coming out. A new book that's already available for pre-release on Amazon. Just look up my name. You'll find it. It's from Pact. And then I'm actually working with a second book with them that will probably be announced in the coming month or so. Although, if you picked up on some of the through lines of what I'm working on, in this conversation, you'll probably pick up on sort of probably where that book will go. But yeah, that's what I've been up to. Hopefully you guys found this interesting. I'll see y'all later. Have a great day and enjoy.